Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Pentagon hasn't yet released the names of the Americans killed in that huge suicide bomb attack in Manbij, Syria, yesterday. Two U.S. troops died, along with a defense contractor and a civilian Defense Department employee. ISIS claimed responsibility for the attack, which killed at least 10 other people. Terrible. But it's also put a spotlight again on the mixed messages coming from Washington. CNN chief international correspondent Clarissa Ward is in northern Syria. We're not saying exactly where for safety concerns, but she's been following the Kurds who've been fighting ISIS, backed by U.S. airstrikes and ground support, like the troops killed yesterday, with an eye on the Turks, who see the Kurds as terrorists and are threatened to attack them. So, Clarissa, what had been the feeling of the Kurds there?
On the one hand, I think there's a sense that they feel confident that they have made huge leaps and bounds in the battle against ISIS. On the other hand, I think they have very real fears now about what comes next for them when U.S. troops begin to withdraw.
So a couple things, Clarissa. First of all, do they on the ground hearing these incredibly mixed messages from the United States, first the president saying we're withdrawing and he wanted to withdraw in, I think, 30 days, then the defense secretary quitting over that. Then even just yesterday, you have Lindsey Graham making the remarkable statement that the president's statements emboldened ISIS and taunted them. The understanding of that statement from Graham is that may even have led to this attack that killed Americans. And at the same time, almost simultaneously, you have the vice president, Mike Pence. News of the attack was out, and he is speaking to ambassadors, I believe, and doesn't even mention the four dead Americans, but says this.
Thanks to the leadership of this commander-in-chief and the courage and sacrifice of our armed forces, we're now actually able to begin to hand off the fight against ISIS in Syria to our coalition partners, and we are bringing our troops home. The caliphate has crumbled and ISIS has been defeated.
I mean, Clarissa, what's the reaction there to words like ISIS has been defeated when ISIS is claiming responsibility for killing four Americans and you have an American lawmaker saying the statements might have led to that bombing?
We just traveled down to the front lines yesterday, Robin, and the battle is still raging. We arrived in heavily armored vehicles, even to drive through liberated areas that should be secure, but they're not, because there are ISIS sleeper cells still throughout vast tracts of this country. They are going out every night, planting roadside bombs, hoping to try to kill Kurdish-led fighters and also coalition forces, special operations forces who are operating on the ground. What we hear again and again from commanders on the ground is, listen, in the next month or a few weeks, we'll probably be able to take the few remaining villages that are still under ISIS control. But that doesn't mean the battle is over, because we still have all this territory on our hands where sympathies for ISIS still exist, where sleeper cells still exist, where you have this complex relationship between ethnic Arabs who resent the presence of Kurdish forces. And all of this is a potentially very toxic brew. That's exactly the environment that groups like ISIS thrive in.
Well, I want to ask you about being in Manbij just a couple days ago, driving past this restaurant where the American troops and other Americans, you know, had stopped to eat. And there is concern that maybe they had, you know, repeatedly stopped there so that there was a sense that they were doing what we know that Americans in these combat zones try not to do, which is set up a pattern that somebody can see. Are there people worried that Americans in Syria might be getting too complacent because they're hearing that ISIS has been defeated from their commander-in-chief? Or it sounds like you're saying, no, there's a real sense that ISIS is still there. And by the way, as you drove past that restaurant, drove down that street, what was the feeling that you got there?
Manbij is nowhere near the front lines. This is a good 7-hour drive from the front lines. This is a city that was liberated from ISIS in September of 2016. And we were actually walking around the old souk. It's just a couple hundred yards away from the restaurant where that explosion took place. there were a lot of people out on the streets. There was a sense of bustling daily life. Residents have come back after the battle to liberate that town, and daily life continues. But there were also a lot of tensions. It did not feel comfortable. As a crew, we discussed trying to get some more interviews while we're on the ground, and we all kind of agreed, you know what, I'm not loving the atmosphere here. I'm not loving the vibe here. There was a definite sense of tension. And sure enough, we drove along and we came upon a funeral for two local security officers who have been killed by a bombing attack on their car. These are the kinds of things that are going on an almost daily basis, Robin. I mean, the question that I have is trying to understand what exactly those U.S. servicemen would have been doing frequenting that restaurant, sitting down in a crowded public space in a town where the veneer of security here is very, very thin. And it all centers on this tenuous balancing act that kind of works to a limited extent. But of course, the fear is once you pull U.S. forces out of that balancing act, that the whole thing tumbles down, that you create this power vacuum. And that, of course, we know creates an opportunity for groups like ISIS.
That's CNN's chief international correspondent, Clarissa Ward, doing some terrific reporting there in northern Syria. Clarissa, thank you so much. Stay safe.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, in California, there is not really a fire season anymore. There are fires all year. More than 7,500 wildfires burned nearly 2 million acres of land in the state last year. That was the most destructive and deadly year in the state's history. But officials preparing for this year have had to stop that prep on federal land because of the shutdown. That means dead trees are piling up and controlled burns to thin, dry vegetation aren't getting done. This is important work and costly, as Capital Public Radio's Ezra David Romero reports from Tahoe National Forest.
Deep in the woods of Central California, giant machines called masticators and skids are plucking trees from the earth as if they were toothpicks.
This equipment is taking the branches off of it, placing it in a pile ready to go to the mill.
That's Joe Flannery with the Tahoe National Forest.
Let's move out of the way here as this piece of equipment's about to drive right where we're standing.
This is forest thinning. It's one way to clear flammable material to prevent large-scale wildfires. It's important because many of California's forests are overgrown. And that, plus climate change, make forests prone to devastating wildfires. Flannery and I are hiking through an area like this not too far from the town of Truckee.
I'm crunching along, but one of the symptoms of an unhealthy forest is this excess understory. It's kind of hard to walk through.
Making our forests safer is expensive. Take the Tahoe National Forest. It's 1.3 million acres. $7 million was recently allocated to help manage the effects of climate change here. But that money will go to treat just 9,800 acres, barely scratching the surface. That's roughly $1,400 per acre, says Kim Carr with the National Forest Foundation, which runs the project.
You can get very discouraged because the challenge is big. We have to keep the urgency around this because, I mean, no one wants to see another paradise.
Carr's referring to the Camp Fire. It was the deadliest and most destructive wildfire in California. It caused 86 deaths and destroyed 18,000 homes and businesses. She says working with foundations expedites the process of turning grant dollars into on-the-ground cleanup efforts. But can we manage our forests on the cheap? UC Berkeley forestry specialist Bill Stewart says yes.
There's certain areas that it is going to cost you $700 an acre on some acres, but other acres you can treat for $50 or $100 an acre.
Stewart thinks there's an even more economical way to thin the forest, but it's often opposed by environmental groups, using more logging as a tool to fund forest health projects.
If we try to do like gardening in someone's suburban areas, it's going to cost billions upon billions upon billions. We found we could reduce fire risk by half on about 80% of the acres, but actually break even.
If Stewart were a doctor, the forest would be a sick patient, and he'd prescribe a mix of logging, thinning, controlled burns, and reforestation.
Do we keep having two totally different ways of doing forest management, or do we try to look at what are the best techniques that the private sectors use and kind of meld them to the goals we have for federal land?
That's a question foresters like Mike Cartmell with the Tahoe National Forest are pondering, because stopping wildfires from growing so big will take removing a lot of trees.
The simple thing that I notice is there's just too many straws in the cup. We have to thin it out, and we have to do it in a responsible way.
We met on a prescribed burn. That's where the forest is thinned and then intentionally lit on fire. Crews are cutting down hazard trees in the charred area. The goal is to make forests like the one Cartmell knew as a kid.
I always remember the big, wide trees and that feeling you get of these decadent, large trees that have been in the landscape for hundreds and hundreds of years. That's what we want to get to.
For forests to get a clean bill of health, Cartmell admits there's a lot more work to do, and that's proving to be expensive, time-consuming, and occasionally controversial. For Here and Now, I'm Ezra David Romero in the Tahoe National Forest.
And again, that important work is not being done right now in federal lands because of the government shutdown. The Canadian TV show Schitt's Creek, that's S-C-H-I-T-T-S, launched its fifth season this week on Pop TV in the U.S. The story of a wealthy family that suddenly loses everything and is forced to move to a dumpy motel in a small rural town they once bought as a joke, a town called Schitt's Creek. It stars Catherine O'Hara, as well as Eugene Levy and his son Daniel Levy, who are also co-executive producers and co-writers. They join me now. Welcome. And where did this idea come from? It's a very different show than anything I've seen.
Thank you very much.
In a great way. I mean, I've watched every episode of it so far.
I brought sort of the first germ of an idea to my dad very early on. The premise of playing on this sort of cultural awareness we now have of how wealthy people live. I think through reality television, we've been able to get an incredibly dimensional, whether we want it or not, idea of how wealthy people live their lives. And I thought it could be an interesting premise to examine as a comedy what would happen if all the money was taken away and these people were forced to confront what really matters in their lives. And I brought the idea to my dad thinking, you know, his comedic sensibility is something that is very specific and grounded in something real, and I thought it could really lend itself to this concept, which I think has the potential or had the potential to go quite broad and cartoony. It needed the opposite. It needed something, an infusion of real, genuine comedy.
And when you say cartoonish, one of the things about this show, and I know that you've both talked about this before, is that because we get to know the characters and we see them in serious situations as well as funny moments, the comedy works even better.
Well, that's a tack that we took right off the top, and that was kind of a comedic tone that we had in the movies that Chris Guest and I did together.
Best in Show and others.
Yeah, which is a grounding of character where you never step outside of your character's boundaries to get a laugh.
And we always approach the show from day one as if it were a drama, and it is. I mean, inherently, it's quite tragic what happens to this family, and the comedy really comes from the characters interacting with each other and interacting with their circumstance. So I think because it's rooted in something real and we're not necessarily playing huge gags, you're able to tightrope walk that fine balance between comedy and also exploring slightly more emotional moments and revelations as well.
Another thing that I was thinking about is that fashion actually plays a pretty big role in the show. Every single character has something that they wear that's pretty unique.
Yeah.
Including you.
Certainly. You know, I think it was really important for me that fashion played a part, a big part in the show. I think because it was an area where we could explore character and not have to write it. And what clothes do in our show is act as a sort of perpetual reminder of where these people came from without having to continually say, remember that time when?
Mm-hmm. Now you can see where these people came from just by looking at them.
A wig store, for one. Because your wife on the show, played by Catherine O'Hara.
Yeah.
By the way, you two have been husband and wife more than once now on screen.
We've done a few things together over the years, Catherine and I. Yeah, we were husband and wife in Best in Show. We were husband and wife in A Mighty Wind.
Right.
We were husband and wife in Over the Hedge.
What do you think it is about the chemistry that the two of you have that works so well time after time with different characters?
I think it's because we have the same style of working. You know, we both come out of improvisational background, mm-hmm. but we're basically actors at heart, not comedians. And we like to get our laughs through character. So everything's got to be set to the point where we know exactly what the character is going to be doing.
How much improv is there in what you're doing with Schitt's Creek?
I would say not very much. I mean, I would say it's 90 to 95% scripted. And
I think it's that extra 5, 10% that really adds that. It's like that special sauce to the show, giving people the freedom to experiment or ad lib a little bit, really sort of customizes each character. And I think from an acting standpoint, it allows you a little bit of freedom to like nestle into who you're playing and feel free to explore that a little bit. There's really no ego involved.
Can you think of
an
example of that happening? Something that you remember that was not scripted?
Well, I don't know. Usually at the end of scenes, when a scene is about to end and a character wants to kind of go on, knowing that they've got the ending to the scene, but what the hell?
I know that there's a scene in the first season between Annie and I where we're fighting over who sleeps in the bed closest to the door, because the idea is if a murderer were to come into the motel, whoever's sleeping closest to the door would get murdered first.
Right.
And Annie came up with this line, which was, "You get murdered first for once." And then it became this sort of back and forth, and we really ran with it. There's just some things like, you know, when Catherine O'Hara does a, you know, first walked in and did her accent as Moira.
"You try enjoying a puff pastry with everyone around you scratching."
I could write very funny things for her, but nothing would be as funny as her delivering those lines in that accent. I mean, she just has the
ability. She came up with that herself?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Catherine's quite amazing. And on a show like this, you know, when you hire Catherine, you're getting more than just somebody who can deliver lines mm-hmm. funny. She brings everything to what she does. She adds so much to the character. She has her own ideas. The wigs, for example, mm-hmm. were her idea. So Moira would wear a different wig depending on, you know, her emotional
right.
mindset of that particular day. She adds so much.
I want to ask you, and let's listen to a clip from the show. This is a scene with a conversation between David, played by you, Daniel, and your boyfriend on the show and business partner, Patrick.
"David, I've spent most of my life not knowing what right was supposed to feel like. And then I met you, and everything changed. You make me feel right, David."
"That is quite possibly one of the most beautiful things I've ever heard anyone say. Outside of the Downton Christmas special."
"It's the truth."
"I know. It's just that my truth is that I am damaged goods, and this has really messed things up for me."
So one of the things about this show that I've never seen anywhere else is that you have a gay relationship that is never talked about by anybody in the town. The parents don't react. It's mm-hmm. not – it's just completely normal.
"Yes, as it should be."
Right.
"I tried to write my experience. I tried to write an experience that I know that friends of mine have had. I think that's the big thing that seems to be connecting with people, is the fact that there is an ease to the relationship and that we write the relationship in a casual way. And that was very deliberate. I think because, you know, we're so accustomed to seeing queer love stories that are put in jeopardy by outside forces. I mean, you know, it's the sort of Brokeback Mountain effect of anytime you see two queer people in love, there has to be some kind of consequence. So to propose a world where there is no consequence and two people can love each other sort of wholly
in small town America.
In small town America, and ultimately show that what comes from that is freedom and love and joy. It's a form, I guess, of sort of quiet protest, saying that this is how things should be. And, you know, the choice to leave homophobia out of the equation on our show was deliberate, because I'm a firm believer that we learn through what we see. And when we feel like we are being taught a lesson, we have our guards up, because we don't want to be schooled on something. But to present something as it should be, I think, has a much more powerful effect in people's homes. And the letters that we've received from families who have watched the show together, and it's changed their own relationships, it's I guess it's a testament to the fact that it does seem to be working, even if it's just one family at a time.
Yeah, a love story is just a love story. And that's the tone that's set on the show. And as Dan just said, the effects are quite amazing when it comes to how it's affecting people out there.
And that was your experience?
Yeah. It was never questioned for me. I mean, sure, there was bullying in high school. But for me, my experience has been relatively easy compared to what is happening in many parts of this country and others. So meeting people in a respectful way and not pinning people against a wall with an agenda, but rather just sort of saying, this is what we're doing. It's seemingly helping people, which is an incredibly rewarding part of the job.
Yeah, it just normalizes everything.
By the way, I said small town America. Where is Schitt's Creek? Have you actually said where it is physically? Do
nope.
we know?
Nope.
We haven't.
It's like
not.
Springfield in The Simpsons?
Yeah.
We have not. Schitt's Creek is Schitt's Creek.
Daniel and Eugene Levy, starring in Schitt's Creek, the new season is out this week in the United States. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you so much for having
us. Pleasure, Jeremy.
And the first four seasons of the show are available on Netflix. You can hear much more of our conversation at hereandnow.org.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Another shakeup today in the leadership at Michigan State University. The school's board of trustees said that Satish Udpa will be the school's new interim president, following an announcement by John Engler that he would resign from that position. Engler had come under fire after saying last week that Larry Nassar's victims were enjoying the spotlight. You remember that Nassar is the former USA Gymnastics team doctor who was convicted of sexual abuse and is serving a decades-long sentence in prison. Nassar also worked at Michigan State University. Joining us now is Marie Wiedmeyer, who's editor-in-chief of the student newspaper there, the State News. Marie, John Engler is the former Republican governor of Michigan. He's now the second MSU president, the first being Lou Anna Simon, to step down following the Nassar scandal. What's the feeling on campus today?
The feeling on campus is very surprised. When the new board was appointed, nobody expected any changes to actually happen. So a lot of students are very excited about the change.
Have you talked with any Nassar survivors, or how are they processing this?
The survivors overall do seem to be happy. I don't want to speak on behalf of all of them, but one of the reporters at the State News spoke with Rachel Den Hollander yesterday, and she was very much in approval of the change.
What do we know about Satish Udpa, who is going to take over as interim president?
He's a former dean of MSU's College of Engineering. He served in the position for quite a few years, and then he also served as an executive vice president to the university, so he's been around for quite a while on MSU's campus.
And he's going to be interim president. What do we know about the search for a permanent president for Michigan State?
Right now, the timeline for a permanent president is that a president's supposed to be named in June 2019. We are unsure if that will still be the case, just because with the new interim president, there might be some changes. We're not really sure how that will play out. But Satish did say today after the meeting that he is not interested in becoming MSU's permanent president.
Mm-hmm. And we should note no word from John Engler about this resignation, but he did submit an 11-page letter to the Board of Trustees blaming his ouster on politics and touting his accomplishments since coming on board. How is that going over?
For the most part, what I've seen on social media is that people are very surprised that he submitted an 11-page letter. And I've also seen a lot of people talking in outrage about the fact that the 11-page letter seemed to be a list of things he had accomplished on campus. And a lot of people are saying that they don't believe he actually accomplished the things he's doing, or what he said he did accomplish was not actually good things.
Mm-hmm. What about just the general sense on the campus? It's starting to heal after this terrible scandal of sexual abuse by Larry Nassar. Now, two presidents ousted.
I think campus is starting to heal. There's a lot less conversation all the time about how the administration is not doing the correct thing. Overall, people do seem to think the university is moving in the correct direction. And there are still ribbons of support, teal ribbons, different teal things around campus, but it's not constantly on everybody's minds anymore from what I've seen with different students.
You're able to just focus on going to school.
Yes, which is something that has not been able to be our sole focus for a while now.
That is Marie Wiedmeyer, who's editor-in-chief of the student newspaper at Michigan State University. It's called The State News. Marie, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And a tender topic now, what to do if an unborn baby is diagnosed with a fatal syndrome. Allison Chang, a fourth-year medical student in Massachusetts, and her husband were confronted with that question when they found out their unborn daughter had trisomy 18, which occurs in one in every 2,500 pregnancies and causes severe developmental delays because of an extra chromosome 18. Former Senator Rick Santorum and his wife chose to have their daughter, even though doctors warned of the trisomy 18 diagnosis. She's now 10 and seems very disabled, but the Santorums say she is thriving. Well, Allison Chang said her daughter had problems so severe they were planning on ending the pregnancy. When it ended naturally, the child died in the womb. The Changs then went through an emotionally devastating removal with the help of a loving medical community. But Allison soon discovered that not everyone has access to the help she got for this horrible choice because of the erosion of choice. She wrote about her experience and the experience of others. We'll link you at hearnow.org as she joins us. Allison, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
First, so sorry for your loss. It's
thank you.
Still a terrible loss. But why did you decide to end the pregnancy? What were you learning? And as a medical student, understanding maybe more than others would.
I just want to be clear that I'm not advocating that all couples and all families make the same choices that we did. Instead, I wanted to make the point that ending a pregnancy under these circumstances can be a loving, compassionate, and medically reasonable choice. And I strongly feel that regardless of what families choose to do in this kind of situation, healthcare professionals and just the community as a whole should be there to support them financially, emotionally, and medically. And that was my main point.
And because also, as you explained to us, trisomy 18 varies. It's on a sort of a spectrum, if I'm reading
yes.
this correctly, and it can be serious, but less severe than it was for your daughter. Your daughter had a very mm-hmm. severe case. What were some of her issues?
Yes. So the pregnancy progressed normally until we went for our nuchal translucency scan, which can tell you how at risk is this baby for chromosomal abnormalities. And the probe hit my belly, and about 2 seconds later, the radiologist who was doing the ultrasound just said, "Oh, I don't like the look of this, Allison." Mm. And basically, there was fluid everywhere, fluid surrounding the lung, fluid in the lymphatic ducts in the neck. And this is when I started thinking about what is she able to feel of all of this? Because if an adult had this level of fluid in their bodies, they would be devastated.
And let's just go over some of the facts that you remind us of. Most babies with trisomy 18 die before they are born. The mm-hmm. majority who make it to term die within 5 to 15 days. The few who live past 1 year have terrible health problems, like not having abdominal wall muscles. pain and discomfort and fatal at some point. And your concern was her and her feeling any of this. And my understanding is that's why you made the decision you did.
Yeah, I mean, I think knowing what life-sustaining interventions can look like is something that I think we've been able to see as people in the medical field that other people might not see. What she would likely be looking at if she were born, you know, that's not something we would want to wish. That, I wouldn't wish that on my worst enemy, and this was my child that I was thinking about. So it had a lot more to do with managing end of life rather than any sort of political feeling about what we should and shouldn't be able to choose.
Well, and then you went to listen to the heartbeat one day, and she was gone. You know, she had died.
Yeah.
And you went through what, you know, anyone who's lost a child or miscarried knows. It's just terrible grief. So sorry. But now, while you were planning on an abortion because of the tremendous fetal distress, you now have to have the deceased fetus removed. And both of these processes were available in your hospital. You had surgery, you went under. You had caring doctors, you had insurance coverage, and a genetics counselor. You were given the remains and a tiny urn to hold and grieve. And it sounds as good as an experience of that kind can get. And then you came across a woman named Jamie, who also decided to end a pregnancy because of trisomy 18. She had none of that. Here's where you remind us of difference state to state. 26 states prohibit abortion coverage under the Affordable Care Act marketplace plans. 11 states extend that restriction to private insurance companies. And only one state, Utah, makes an exception in the case of severe fetal impairment, which is what this is. So are you saying that somebody with the same kind of terrible fetal impairment can't get an abortion covered by insurance in a hospital? She had to go to a clinic rather than a hospital?
So she's actually someone I met through a pregnancy loss support group on the internet. And I was trying to find information online about what do people do when they're in the situation where they know that they're going to lose a pregnancy. And the advice that I got from that time was, you know, treat the baby as much as a living, like a living child as possible. And this kind of came as a surprise to me in a way, because that's just so different from how I'd heard people talk about abortion in the past. And she found this same pregnancy loss support group when her own child was diagnosed with trisomy 18. And the first thing I was confused about was the fact that she didn't have the kind of placental biopsy that I had. This is known as chorionic villus sampling, and it's basically what you do if you're a little too early to get an amniocentesis. But she had a couple different screening tests, basically, which can tell you how at risk you are of having this kind of diagnosis, but it's not a diagnosis itself. But that was still kind of the first little bit of a red flag to me about, like, oh, she is not getting the same care that I'm getting.
What you found is that she lives in Missouri, which is one of those states, as all states are except Utah, that doesn't cover pregnancy termination in the case of severe fetal impairment. The hospital is going to charge her $8,000. They didn't have that. So they had to go to a clinic that offered abortions. Past protesters, you know, shouting at them as they went in. She is in a chair with, you know, feet in stirrups, gets a simple shot and is sort of awake through the procedure. And then afterwards doesn't get the things that, you know, you'd been learning online that people might want, the remains to bury or... it's just a completely different experience.
Yeah, that really, to me, spoke to the fact that these policies don't just affect the destitute and the uneducated, but this is something that extends well beyond that. These are upper middle class young professionals.
Well, I was going to say that if they hadn't been able to afford that $8,000, and then there were extra costs on top of that, the fetus was determined to be older, and that cost a little bit more, and if they hadn't been able to afford that, what? She might have had to deliver a child that was tremendously harmed and statistically probably wouldn't have lived.
Yeah, and coming off of my experience, I recognized how privileged I was kind of abstractly at the time. Then hearing her experience with just all of these horrific challenges on top of that.
Like the crowd of protesters, she had a walkthrough at the facility that offered abortions. What were they yelling?
So, you know, they were saying, that's daddy's little girl you're killing. And to be going through this experience and to have people shouting this to me speaks to the fact that people don't totally understand all of the reasons that people pursue abortion. And I think as a community, we have a responsibility to make sure that the most vulnerable are protected. And I think that for a lot of people, they would argue that the fetus is the most vulnerable here. But I think that we should place more trust in parents to choose what is best for their families and support them in that.
Well, you make it clear that it's not, you know, yes, you wish your friend had had better treatment, but you make it clear, the bottom line, it is for the fetus. It is for the unborn mm-hmm. child to mm-hmm. protect them from pain.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think knowing the statistics, to me, I wanted to spare her from having that kind of experience of what she was actually going through.
It sounds like others have supported your choice, maybe been enraged, as some people are, about your friend's lack of choice. But has mm-hmm. that helped?
I mean, it's so heartwarming to get letters of support from people sending their condolences, saying that they would have made a similar decision or that they actually have made a similar decision. So having the opportunity to hear that from so many different people and strangers, it's been a really wonderful experience.
And by the way, we understand you are pregnant again, and testing has shown that the child is clear of the trisomy 18.
Yes.
So congratulations and our best to you.
Thank you. Thanks so much. And at this point, we're cautiously optimistic that everything's going to be okay.
That's Allison Chang, fourth-year medical student at Harvard Medical School, who wrote about losing a child in the womb to trisomy 18. She lives in Massachusetts, got financial and medical and emotional support through insurance in her hospital. But she also tells the story of a woman who wanted to end the same kind of pregnancy, who lives in Missouri and couldn't get insurance or hospital care. Allison, thank you so much for speaking with us, and best of luck to you.
Thanks so much.
The NFL playoffs are down to the final four teams, and by late Sunday night, we'll know who will play in the Super Bowl next month in Atlanta. The LA Rams will play the Saints in New Orleans for the NFC crown, and the New England Patriots will battle the Chiefs in Kansas City for the AFC title. Mike Pesca is here now, sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com, and joins us now. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
Not a lot of surprises here. These are the four best teams in the NFL this season.
Right. Well, maybe a surprise is that there aren't a lot of surprises, though we have been in a recent era where the best teams are making it deep in the playoffs and making the Super Bowl. So last year, the Patriots and the Eagles. Before that, we've had a consistent run of top teams. But, you know, in the earlier part of this decade, Green Bay won the Super Bowl as a 6 seed. The Giants won as a 4 seed. The Ravens won as a 4 seed. So now we're in an era where the top teams are winning more. Why? No idea.
And talk about the quarterback matchups here, because each of these teams has a good one.
Yeah, a good to great one to perhaps in, you know, Tom Brady, the greatest of all time, perhaps in his opponent Mahomes on Kansas City, the greatest we've seen with 50 touchdowns thrown this year, the greatest we've seen in the modern era. And the modern era is a great quarterback era. Drew Brees, he's the third quarterback I'm going to mention. He's going to make the Hall of Fame. And then you have Goff, who's the quarterback of the Rams, and he is young, not as young as Mahomes. I don't know if he's a great quarterback, but he does helm a great offense, which relies on running backs, and I use the plural because Todd Gurley is the Rams running back, and he's sensational. And last week, we found out that C.J. Anderson, who's been all around the NFL, was also hired by the Rams. Few of us who weren't paying attention to football knew this, and he seems to have put on about 40 pounds since when he was in college, and he ran for over 100 yards like a Mack truck.
Yeah, well, there you go, which is as Mack trucks go. But
as Mack trucks
I want to ask you about the coaches as well, because you know, Bill Belichick versus Andy Reid of the Chiefs, mm-hmm. Bill Belichick of the Patriots. I mean, this is a battle of wits. So your thoughts about the role of the coaches, and also just speaking of coaches, 7 new head coaches hired, all but one are white, you know, and yeah. 3/4 of the players black. So thoughts about coaches going into the games this weekend and then in general.
Okay, both of those things. The coaches, coaching is more important in the NFL than any sport, mm-hmm. and the Patriots obliterated the San Diego Chargers because of coaching, and mm-hmm. Bill Belichick has the advantage over anyone. All of the coaches in this game are good to great coaches. But the thing about Andy Reid is he's never had huge success in the postseason. He's gotten into his own. He devises these great game plans, but then in the last minute will make a mistake in time management. If he could beat Belichick, I think it will silence a lot of his critics.
He almost did. He almost did. What was it? 43-40 in October. But go ahead.
And we got right. He has another chance. Yeah. On to the bigger issue and the bigger societal issue of the lack of African-American coaches in the NFL. It was 8. There were a bunch of firings. I would say that many of the coaches, many of whom were black, did deserve to get fired. And Marvin Lewis, the coach of the Bengals, he had run out the string there over, you know, over a decade at the helm. So we're seeing a situation where there are only a couple, 2 black coaches, 4 minority coaches. And that's due to a lot of reasons. But one reason is the pipeline. And these days, offensive coaches are in high demand. Sean McVay, the coach of the Rams, is this young genius that everyone wants a Sean McVay. Well, it turns out, for also a number of reasons, coaches who are offensive coordinators are more likely to be white. When there have been black coaches hired, they've more often come from the defensive side of the ball. Why is that? It's something to address. But that is that. I guess, is the proximate reason for what we're seeing now in terms of the racial dynamic of NFL head coaches.
Mike, speaking of race, there is some controversy about the performers at the Super Bowl halftime. Should I tell us what's going on there?
Well, I guess, are we talking about Maroon 5?
Travis Scott having to ask Colin Kaepernick for permission, apparently, before he accepted to do this.
Yeah, the NFL has, like a lot of entertainment, they want to appeal to the broadest amount of people with their halftime acts, but sometimes they get in their own way with who they invite. I think Maroon 5 just in general wasn't seen as, you know, a cutting edge type of entertainment. And a few people have turned down that spot from the NFL. It's a little bit parallel to what's going on with the Oscars. I think a recent poll also showed that people expect the Super Bowl to be more politicized this year. I don't know why, except maybe what we're talking about with Kaepernick, but also the idea that everything in life seems to be more politicized this year.
One more thing, Mike, switching to baseball. This is the time of year when fans are watching to see where free agent players are going to end up. But for the second straight season, not a lot of movement.
Yeah. I think what we're seeing is that teams have, they don't have a salary cap, but what they have is a system where if teams spend too much, they essentially get punished. And this is causing some of the previous big spenders to tone it down. I don't know if it's collusion. Some last year, players got together and alleged collusion, but owners are at least deciding that if they don't outbid each other crazily, the market will calm down and they could get some very good players, like, say, Manny Machado, who will get paid millions and millions of dollars, but team owners are deciding not to bid against themselves. So there's more of a calmness in the market. This is exactly why the owners designed it as they did. But the players, some of the best players who probably in years past would be getting paid a lot, are getting, or at least aren't being signed right now.
Okay. Mike, thanks.